This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the High Yield Cash Account on public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A High Yield Cash Account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Housing. What do you think? Been a while since we've checked in. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday, today the 25th of January. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with the American housing market, the American rental housing market, to be precise, and how rent comes to be the rent in the first place. Today, the White House announced a bunch of things it's doing to help the 44 million or so American households that rent the roofs over their heads. The Federal Trade Commission is going to look into whether some tenant background checks are unfair. The Federal Housing Finance Agency is going to look into limiting big rent increases in the properties that that agency helps finance. And while it is true that, yes, rents in some markets are finally cooling, the national median rent, though, is still up more than 20% since the beginning of the pandemic. That's from the website Apartment List. So, Marketplace's Matt Levin spent his day in pursuit of a foundational answer. How exactly do landlords figure out what they should charge for rent in the first place?
Sid Lacoretti is trying to rent out a 680-square-foot, one-bedroom apartment in Oakland, California. It's got a renovated deck, a kitchen island, some LED light fixtures, all for $2,200 a month. How'd he decide on $2,200? He shopped around, just like his tenants would.
I pulled up five different Zillow listings that are comparables in the neighborhood, looked at what the amenities are. You know, some of them were $1,895, but I said, oh, well, look at that. Those are the old Whirlpool appliances.
Lacoretti says pricing the 300 or so units he owns isn't an exact science, which is why he doesn't trust the number the algorithm in his property management software spits out as the recommended rent.
I use it very sparingly because what it doesn't take into account for is the quality of the apartment.
Smaller landlords still mostly look at publicly available comps, says Ben Teresa at Virginia Commonwealth University. But bigger corporate landlords, and especially those in the growing single-family rental market, they're eagerly volunteering their info to more sophisticated big data platforms.
Property managers will input, you know, the rents, vacancy rates, and other types of data, perhaps operating expenses and things like that.
Teresa says if enough landlords are telling the algorithm exactly what they're charging, it raises questions about whether rising rents are partly because of collusion.
It does provide a coordinating action across a marketplace that would not exist without the technology.
Of course, renters also have a lot more data on local rents than they had, say, 10 years ago. But Shanti Singh at the advocacy group Tenants Together says with the better data landlords have, if you're a renter,
I'd argue you're in a worse position.
Unless, she says, you live in a rent-controlled apartment. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
As long as we're on housing, I'm going to keep going here for a minute. The real estate site Redfin said today that by its data, pending home sales were up almost 3% in December from November. That is the first month-on-month increase since October of 21. Lots of other indications of buyers coming back to the market, the company says. after the bump in mortgage rates we saw last year started scaring people off. More customers are asking for home tours, and more people are getting in touch with Redfin agents to begin with. Wall Street, this middle of the week workday, just about even. Actually, all three indexes will have the details when we do the numbers. A glance at the economic calendar for the week reminds us that the Federal Reserve's favorite measure of inflation comes out Friday morning, the Personal Consumption Expenditures Price Index. And as enamored as Jay Powell and his colleagues in the big building on Constitution Avenue in Washington might be with it, one cannot help but wonder, is PCE the most accurate measure of price increases? Put another way, does it deserve all the Fed love it gets? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer is on that one.
Imagine driving a car only using the rearview mirror, not paying any attention to what's in front of you. That's kind of what the Fed has done with the PCE price index, which tells us what happened the previous month. Quincy Crosby, chief global strategist for LPL Financial, says she also keeps an eye on more current measures.
We see from other indicators that the path of inflation is coming down more quickly.
These indicators might not show up right away in the lagging PCE. Things like rent, which Crosby says is edging down. Another problem with the PCE, it's not as reliable as usual because of how the pandemic has distorted inflation.
It's an interesting period right now.
That's Nationwide Chief Economist Kathy Bosjancic with the understatement of the year. She says the PCE is a broad measure of inflation. It doesn't give as much weight to consumer staples like gas as its flashy cousin, the Consumer Price Index. Bosjancic says there's a gap between the two, with the PCE consistently showing lower inflation.
Gasoline prices in the summer had soared to up and around $5 per gallon. You know, during that period, that would help explain one reason why we had the gap.
Also during the pandemic, demand for furniture and other stay-at-home stuff skyrocketed, sending those prices soaring, says Michael Gapin, head of U.S. economic research at B of A Securities.
So the final costs of things that households bought went sharply higher. It was a consumer-driven inflation story.
But Gapin says the PCE only told part of that story. He does think the PCE will become more accurate as pandemic inflation fades. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Out to Marina Del Rey the other day over by LAX to visit the headquarters of a multi-million dollar water brand.
Mike's upstairs. I can have him come down. Great. Or however you guys
want. No, we'll go upstairs. That's fine.
It's more like a warehouse than an office, really. High ceilings, exposed wood framing, concrete floors. Also,
oh, yes, a skate ramp. That's just what we need.
Next to that skate ramp and an oversized model of a human skull, five people sit at a big table working at computers and sipping cans of liquid death.
Before we ever had real product, we launched a Facebook page with like a fake commercial.
Yeah.
We never had real cans, so we tested it on the internet first, and the video ended up getting millions of views. The page had, you know, more followers than Aquafina within a few months. So I think we knew that we were onto something that could be really big.
That's Mike Cesario. He's the founder and CEO of Liquid Death. It is a canned water company, about 160 employees, soft launched in 2017 and got a whole bunch of attention with viral marketing stunts like, later on they did this, selling a limited edition skateboard painted red, the paint mixed with a real vial of Tony Hawk, the famous skateboarder's, blood. Seriously. But it worked. As of its last funding round, Liquid Death is valued at $700 million. You can buy a can of it for a couple of bucks at more than 70,000 stores across the country. And if you are unfamiliar, You will come to know it soon. It's among the top-selling drinking waters on Amazon, and it is the most followed beverage brand on TikTok in the United States. So says Food Business News.
We realize that 98% of people actually hate marketing. They're willing to spend $10 a month to not have ads.
Right.
And if you can make people laugh, they will just have a deeper connection with your brand, regardless of the functional differences of your liquid.
It is in some ways a company built on viral marketing, right? I mean, You see a water product that's called Liquid Death, and you go, holy cow, man, and people start talking about that.
Yeah.
Which reminds me, really, we should back up and explain what Liquid Death is. For those who are not familiar somehow, what's the 30-second pitch on this company?
We're trying to make health and sustainability 50 times more fun. Typically, all the most fun, hilarious marketing over the last 30 years is all for junk food, alcohol, energy drinks, candy. Like, what are the funniest campaigns most people remember? It's like Bud Light, Snickers, you know, McDonald's, Carl's Jr. Whereas healthy food doesn't really ever market in that fun, irreverent youth culture way.
All right. Do we have a can of the subject in question nearby that I can just grab? The flagship product, again, it's water, comes in a can with a gold skull on the front, Liquid Death in Gothic script on it, and a little origin story on the back. So I want you to do something for me. I want you to read the blurbs on the side of this can for me.
I think it'd be funnier if you read it.
Well, it would, but, you know, you're the guy, so.
This,
you know what? Actually, maybe it would be funnier if I read it.
Yeah, it's going to be hilarious.
Well, we'll see. This infinitely recyclable can of stone-cold mountain water came straight from the Alps to murder your thirst. When a group of teenagers sets off into the mountains for a weekend of drinking regular water in plastic bottles, they become hunted by an aluminum can of mountain water that was dead set on murdering the thirst and recycling their souls. And then it goes on from there in that vein. First of all, I love this. But second of all, do you drink beer at all? Do you drink?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you know who Gray Coke is from Stone?
No.
Okay. Stone, which was the original sort of West Coast IPA, has a very similar vibe to this. They've got gargoyles on their can.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Each of their
Arrogant beverages. Bastard. Ale.
Arrogant Bastard,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
This is kind of in that vein of, you know what? We're just having a good time. That's exactly what I thought of. And, you know, Greg's been amazingly successful.
Yeah, and craft beer was definitely an inspiration from a brand perspective when we were creating Liquid Death, because I thought some of the coolest can designs and brand names were in the world of craft beer, like Arrogant Bastard.
Right.
And like, no one thinks that's weird. No one's saying, oh my God, craft beer company creates beer called Arrogant Bastard. Is this okay? Is this edgy? Oh,
yeah, but you're doing water, man.
But what's
kids
the
are drinking this.
Exactly.
Which is great. We want kids to drink more water, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But do we want a 12-year-old carrying around a can that says Liquid Death with a skull on it?
100%. And there's hundreds of parents that agree. Like, we get messages saying, Liquid Death, thank you. Finally, my 9-year-old is excited to drink water instead of soda.
Hmm.
And it's like, it's all because of a brand. It feels like something cool you're not supposed to have, but it's literally the healthiest thing you can drink. And it's like, we have people who are like, hey, I don't really want to drink alcohol. And now I feel way more a part of the occasion when I can walk around with a Liquid Death and people aren't saying, oh, how come you're not drinking?
Who is your competition then, right? Because the beverage space, right, and now the non-alcoholic water space is populated by ginormous companies. And for as much success as you're having, you ain't it. Do you worry about the Cokes and the Pepsis? Or you're like, yeah, you do your thing and I'm going to do mine.
Yeah, no, we don't worry about that at all. Because the hardest thing, anybody can put water in a can, right?
that's the tease cut right there. Yeah. Anybody can put water in a can.
But that's not why we're successful. And I think...
Okay, wait. So why are you successful?
Because we've built a really strong brand that has created legitimate fandom and obsession for the product. And that is something that Coke and Pepsi historically have been really bad at doing, which is why they acquire companies more so than they create, you know, viral brands or fandom on their own.
You rely on, right? And your stock and trade is viral marketing. I'm sure you spend some money on conventional marketing, whatever. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. But viral marketing is your thing. So how do you, as a marketing guy, how do you gauge that? How do you know what's going to work?
And that's the billion-dollar question, right?
Literally billion-dollar question, right?
If you can figure out how to consistently do that, you're going to have a pretty big business. And I think we've had a pretty great track record. We have a pretty good process for how we determine what's a good idea, what's a great idea, what's a bad idea.
Is it like a corporate secret? What's the secret to figuring that out? Because
well, if you want the secret, you can buy the company for $10 billion. It's probably, I've used this analogy a ton lately. We think about our marketing team more like Saturday Night Live. Like we're an entertainment machine and we're constantly trying to put what we put out on the level of an SNL sketch. Like even though this might be a commercial, what could legitimately find its way onto Saturday Night Live and people would be like, oh, that's really funny and that makes sense there. And if you can do that, I mean, something like Saturday Night Live has been around 30 years because they continually bring in the right creative minds. They always are just making fun of what's happening in culture at the moment, bringing in interesting celebrities and people as guests to kind of come into their weird world. And that's what we've been doing as well.
You're an entertainment company with a water brand attached, right?
Right, exactly, yeah.
Mike, thanks a lot. I appreciate you.
Yeah, of course.
Coming up.
Couple those together, you have basically a black box.
Medical care as profit center. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 9 today, just a touch. We'll call it flat, 33,743. The NASDAQ went the other way, down 20 points. That is almost 0.2%. Closed at 11,313. The S&P 500 also basically flat, 4,016. Microsoft slid 0.6%. Yesterday, the software giant issued a disappointing revenue outlook for the current quarter. Apple faded almost 0.5%. Alphabet, parent company of Google, which I think probably we're going to stop saying because everybody knows that, right? Gave back 2.5%. News Corp added 5.6% today after Rupert Murdoch dropped plans to merge the media giant with Fox News. Fox rang up 2.5% today. Some bank stocks moved higher. Capital One lifted 0.9%. U.S. Bancorp grew 5.3% after narrowly missing analysts' best guesses on fourth quarter earnings. Bond prices were up. The yield on the 10-year T-note down 3.44% on the 10-year. You are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
And now a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns. Meaning, when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line. And your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, and California. Whatever else those seven states may have in common, they all border the Colorado River, and they're all up against yet another federal deadline to limit their water use in the face of the generational drought we're having out here in the American West. Do not let the rains of the past couple of weeks fool you, by the way. The Colorado Seven have till Tuesday to come to terms on massive voluntary cuts on water use, or the Bureau of Reclamation says it is going to figure out the non-voluntary cuts for them. Marketplace's Savannah Marr has been following this saga for us for a while now, and as she reports, it is about water, sure. It's also about power, hydroelectric, and other.
Around 22% of the energy generated in the West comes from hydropower. In times of drought, the cities and towns that rely on that power turn to other sources
that are dirtier and less efficient and far more expensive.
Like oil and natural gas, says Brian Hill, who heads up the public electric utility in Page, Arizona, with water levels on Lake Powell reaching historic lows.
We're having to go out on the marketplace. The cost of the energy that we bring into Page has at least doubled.
He hopes the wet weather we've been seeing in the West will translate to a boost for the reservoir come spring. Adrian Marshall, a hydrologist at the Colorado School of Mines, says there are no guarantees.
We don't know how much that will help the reservoirs and help hydropower production.
If the rest of the winter is warmer or drier, she says a lot of mountain snowpack could evaporate. And even if we do get some good runoff,
we also should not count on one wet water year to get us out of a long-term mess.
But that's exactly what some water managers are banking on as they debate the best way to conserve water, says John Fleck at the University of New Mexico.
There's still a lot of tension about how deep we need to cut now or how much we can put off.
In hopes the mega drought will let up in the coming years. Brian Hill with the utility in Page, Arizona, says he gets it.
Nobody wants to give up their water. Water is wealth.
But it's also power. And without some major compromises, he says cities like Page are going to have a hard time keeping the lights on. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Private equity is everywhere in this economy. It's in local journalism, it's in retail, and it's in healthcare, too. The catch is how private equity usually works out, with job cuts and added debt, and sometimes chains and companies in bankruptcy. In the healthcare field, addiction treatment in particular has become a prime investment target, which means the people most affected by all the corporate maneuvering are among the most vulnerable. From WPLN and in partnership with Kaiser Health News, Blake Farmer has that story.
Even amid the pandemic in 2020, the Nashville Recovery Center tried to get people together as safely as it could for things like a sing and share night, also posted online.
So we don't talk about it. We pretend it's not there.
A singer-songwriter on staff named Mitzi Dawn started the weekly event, and people in recovery showed up by the hundreds. It was precisely the kind of offering founder Ryan Kane, who himself was in recovery, envisioned. A safe place to drop in, play pool, watch a game, or meet with a 12-step sponsor. He described the program in a chat posted to Facebook in 2020.
We make it open pretty much to anyone, any time of day. About 80% of what we do doesn't cost anything.
Then he sold the business and its sober living and detox facilities for an undisclosed sum. Mitzi Dawn recalls the all-hands meeting where that was announced in the summer of 2021.
And they brought us donuts and said, we have an exciting announcement. We're selling it, but don't freak out because nothing's going to change. It's just they have more money, and so you're going to be able to be paid more.
The new owner was BRC Recovery, a company out of Texas that had recently won backing from two private equity firms. Dawn says it became clear to her the new owner wasn't interested in spending more, but less. Pay schedules changed. She says she waited 6 months for her final check after the sing and share budget was scaled back. Dawn moved on to work for another independent treatment facility, but she worried about her colleagues. She says many of them, like herself, are also in recovery.
You have a perfect breeding ground to be able to take advantage of a lot of really good-hearted, well-intentioned people.
Many addiction treatment centers end up hiring former clients who need the work and have relevant experience. But usually there's a policy of requiring that they be sober for at least 2 years. For Nancy Milam at Nashville Recovery, it was just 6 months. She'd been through the same sober living program where she'd become a house manager. Part of her compensation was getting to live there. She also had to handle residents' medication, which could be abused. She says she was fortunate to maintain her sobriety.
I would say that it was not with my recovery in the best interest. I think it served their need, and I was ambitious that it should not have happened.
She left a year ago after she says the company still hadn't helped her start her certification as a drug counselor as promised. BRC did not answer specific questions, but said in a statement that many of the complaints patients and former employees shared are no longer accurate. BRC's expansion was just one of 127 mergers and acquisitions in the behavioral healthcare sector that year, a record according to Capstone Partners. And those deals were largely fueled by private equity. Eileen O'Grady is with the nonprofit watchdog Private Equity Stakeholder Project.
Private equity, regardless of what industry they're investing in, want to double or triple their investment in a pretty short period of time.
By one research group's estimate, there are roughly 14,000 treatment centers that dot the country, and private equity has seen vast opportunity there. O'Grady says the fragmented industry could use some standardization, which investors could help with. But she's concerned by the lack of regulation and transparency.
More than other areas of healthcare, addiction medicine or mental health treatment are very, very opaque in the same way that private equity as an industry is very opaque. Couple those together, you have basically a black box.
With so many families desperate to find help for loved ones in addiction, sometimes the best option is the only one. And O'Grady says that demand is great for investors, but not for patients. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, your mileage may vary on this one, and honestly, I hope it does. But according to the good people at Gallup, more of us are discontented at work than has been the case in a decade. The breakdown goes like this. 18% of Americans said that last year they were actively disengaged from their jobs. 32% of us say they are actively engaged last year. That is down, though, from 36% in 2020. And before you say, well, yes, of course, Kai, you work remotely, you're less engaged. Gallup says engagement is down no matter if you're working remotely, hybrid, or going into the office. All right, we got to go. Here, though, is your moment of economic context, which comes as I remember I've got to start on our taxes this weekend. I saw this in the Wall Street Journal research from the Treasury Department and the University of Michigan that shows that in 2020, the man's name was listed first on 88% of joint returns filed by opposite-sex married couples. And lest you think that that is just older married couples or inertia or whatever, it turns out that among couples filing jointly for the first time in 2020, 76% of them put the man's name first. Huh. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Jake Cherry, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening
because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.